offensive has taken swaths of territory along the border between the two nations and captured villages near the front line in the east. And in more national news, student protests marked college commencements around the country over the weekend. Students walked out of ceremonies at Duke University when comedian and Israel supporter Jerry Seinfeld took the stage. At the University of Texas, a student took the stage and unfurled the Palestinian flag as students cheered.
We are here to celebrate. We are here to celebrate the great accomplishments of our 2024 graduates.
Students have won concessions at some schools. On Tuesday, Harvard students took down their tents after the administration agreed to hear their demands. And Vice President Kamala Harris appeared to shock herself and others when 12 minutes into a forum sponsored by an Asian American political group, she dropped the F-bomb.
And then you need to kick that fucking door down. Excuse my language.
We gotta make t-shirts with that saying, kick the fucking door down.
Harris was describing the importance of overcoming barriers and being the first woman vice president. On Tuesday, White House press spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre explained.
We're talking about someone who has broken glass ceilings, right? We're talking about someone who can speak to, about what it's like to go through that process. And so she's incredibly passionate, and I will leave it there.
Closer to home, Mayor Eric Adams was asked Tuesday about the police killing of a 19-year-old Bangladeshi man in his own home in March. Adams said he had called the family after the horrific killing, but they had refused to talk to him.
My heart goes out to the family. I reached out to the mom and dad and the family, and they did not want to communicate at the time, and I respect that. It's a very painful encounter, and I've experienced visiting many parents after they lost a loved one to some form of violence.
The Rosario family responded in a news release. Contrary to what he claimed this morning, Mayor Adams never personally reached out to our family. We don't need comforting words from the mayor. We need action, and so far we've seen no action from Mayor Adams. And it was another day in the Manhattan fraud trial of former President Donald Trump, as his former fixer, disgraced lawyer Michael Cohen, continued his testimony about plans to cover up a $130,000 payment to silence a woman who had a tryst with Trump. Among the attendees was House Speaker Michael Johnson, who spoke to reporters afterwards.
He lied to Congress. He lied to the IRS. He lied to federal election officials. Even Cohen's own lawyer testified to a grand jury that he is not reliable. So there's nothing that he presents here that should be given any weight at all by a jury, and certainly not this judge.
As the trial enters its third week, there has been an uptick in threats against Judge Juan Merchan, accusing him of treason and calling for the execution of witnesses. Paul D'Arienzo, New York.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You're tuned to WBAI New York, WBAI.org online. That was Pacifica's Paul D'Arienzo with the headline news. The just concluded program was Independent News Hour. That's before the headline news. Clearing the Fog with Margaret Flowers is next. Stay tuned.
They were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. This week, I interviewed Anne Wright. Anne is a retired colonel and a former State Department official who resigned in 2003 from the State Department over the U.S.'s going into Iraq, invading Iraq. And she has since then become an incredibly active anti-war peace activist. And so I spoke with Anne, who's currently in Washington, D.C., about the projects that she's involved in right now. We talked about the State Department resignations that have been happening over the genocide in Gaza. We talked about the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition. She is part of that. It is trying to sail to Gaza with 5,000 tons of humanitarian aid, but they've run into some obstacles, which she talks about, and what people can do to help out. And then also about the NATO protests that are coming this July, when there is a NATO meeting in Washington, D.C. on the 75th anniversary of the founding of NATO. And so Anne talks about what's going to be going on there and how people can get involved in that. I hope you'll stick around for that interview. Anne is an amazing person and so inspiring. Before we get to that, though, I do want to talk about some things that are in the news. The genocide in Palestine continues, not just in Gaza, where it is incredibly severe, but also throughout the West Bank. And at present, the Israeli occupying forces are invading Rafah. Settlers are continuing to destroy the humanitarian aid that's waiting at the border of Rafah to enter Gaza, where 1.4 million people are in that region, the southern part of Gaza, and starvation is occurring in Gaza, and the killing of aid workers continues. There was just a van, a United Nations aid van, that was hit by Israeli occupying forces, and the driver of that, a United Nations employee, was killed in that attack. Last week, the United Nations took a vote on giving Palestine full membership in the United Nations. This was done by the United Nations General Assembly in April. The United Nations Security Council voted on whether to grant Palestine full membership, and it's required to get full membership that the Security Council approve it. It was interesting that the vote was 12 countries in favor of giving Palestine membership, but of course the United States was the only country to vote against it and vetoed it, so that that could not move forward. So the General Assembly then took that to a vote, another resolution. 193 countries are members of the United Nations, 143 of them voted yes, only 9 countries voted against, the others, 25, abstained from the vote. But Ben Norton on geopoliticaleconomy.org reports that the 9 countries, including the United States, that voted against granting Palestine full membership only represent about 5% of the global population. They're standing in the way of recognizing Palestine, a country that 143 nations around the world already have official diplomatic relations with Palestine. So this vote in the General Assembly won't grant Palestine full membership, but it does make it so that Palestine is eligible for full membership. They urge the Security Council to vote on that, and it does grant Palestine other rights, such as they will be seated in the General Assembly, although they will not at this time be allowed to vote. U.S. Congress continues to protect the state of Israel. U.S. senators last week sent a letter to the International Criminal Court warning it that if the ICC targets Israel, such as putting out an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu, that the United States will target the ICC. And even though the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court, it threatens the ICC. It has in the past as well, threatening the ICC with sanctions. But the fact that many people may not be aware of, under the presidency of George W. Bush, the Hague Invasion Act was passed. Of course, the ICC is in The Hague in the Netherlands. And that act gives the United States the right to invade The Hague to free anyone from, like, the United States who is being prosecuted. So threatening the ICC with invasion for trying to hold Israel accountable for its genocide. And then last Friday, South Africa asked the International Court of Justice, or World Court, this is the Court of the United Nations, which is also in The Hague in the Netherlands, South Africa, which has a suit against Israel for committing genocide under the Genocide Convention, and that case continues to move forward through the ICJ. This process will take a few years, but South Africa did ask the ICJ to place provisional measures on Israel to stop the genocide. The ICJ found that it was plausible that Israel is committing genocide and imposed provisional measures on Israel, which they have ignored. I think this is the third or fourth time since that decision was given at the end of January that South Africa has asked for more measures as the situation has worsened, and this time they're asking the court to order Israel to withdraw from Rafah. It's interesting that more countries are continuing to join in with South Africa on that case. Countries can submit what's called a declaration of intervention in joining South Africa. And what those declarations of intervention do is my understanding, they make it more likely that the United Nations will take action if the court finds Israel to be guilty of committing genocide, something that many of us are watching happen every day. President Biden, I guess, is feeling some pressure from the amazing protests that have been going on across the United States. And of course, they're also happening all around the world. Biden threatened Israel over its invasion of Rafah, but that threat really doesn't have any merit because, of course, the United States is the number one backer of Israel at this point. The invasion of Rafah began last Tuesday, May 7th, and it has closed the Rafah crossing where hundreds and hundreds of aid trucks have been waiting to get into Gaza. South Africa submitted its request to the court on Friday, May 10th. Major protests have been going on in Malmo, Sweden, over the Eurovision contest. Thousands of people out in the streets protesting the inclusion of Israel in that event. And Anne talks about the fact that there's one of the ships from the Freedom Flotilla Coalition arrived in Malmo, Sweden, in time for those protests of Eurovision. And then a new group that has formed, you'll remember Aaron Bushnell, the active duty military member who self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. in protest of Israel's genocide in Gaza. His action has been an incredible inspiration to so many active duty members of the military. You'll remember that I interviewed recently Larry Hebert, who is on hunger strike to call for an end to the genocide and a ceasefire. Bushnell's men, as they call themselves, hacked 30,000 Western printers to send flyers to them containing Bushnell's message. They're trying to get around the media ignoring of the, you know, genocide and the necessity of a ceasefire and an end to that. And then the campus movement across the United States and continues to grow around the world. It is amazing and inspiring. Anne and I talk about that a little bit, but more and more campuses continue to form encampments, calling on their institutions to divest from Israel, to, you know, call for a ceasefire, to boycott Israel. And in California, the University of California system has seen incredible, terrible retaliation against those who are demonstrating in support of Palestine. At the University of Southern California, where you may remember the commencement was canceled after they canceled the valedictorian's speech, faculty passed a resolution censoring the university president, Carol Folt, and the provost, Andrew Guzman. They said in that resolution, you know, due to the university's actions around the campus encampment protest for Gaza, that there was, quote unquote, widespread dissatisfaction and concern among the faculty about administrative decisions and communications related to these events. They're calling for a task force to investigate what the university has done. At UC California Irvine, the university suspended students on May 8th who participated in the campus demonstration. And as a result of that, the encampment continues to go on, but the members of that camp are not negotiating with the university and calling for those suspensions to be lifted. At the University of California, Los Angeles, police were sent in to clear that camp. And you may be aware that prior to that, there were times when counter-protesters, not sure exactly who they were, Zionists, pro-Israel counter-protesters, attacked students in those camps as the police watched them do that. The police cleared that camp. They were in riot gear. They had rubber bullets. Five people were hit with rubber bullets, some of them seriously injured and taken to the hospital. 132 people were arrested as well. The University of California, San Diego, the police were sent in to clear that as well. And so as a result, the UAW Local 4811, which is a student workers in the University of California system union, are voting to strike May 13th to the 15th over the university's actions. And on May 3rd, they filed an unfair labor charge with the university. This is a little bit tricky because due to the Taft-Hartley Act, unions are not allowed to strike over political affairs, but they're going forward with this, and we wish them luck. At the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where there was an encampment, you know, this is considered a liberal institution, police were sent in by the university to clear the camp. They arrested more than 130 students, faculty members, and community members in that action. In other news, in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was murdered in May of 2020, residents have been working very hard to establish community control of the police. And their most recent effort has been to gather petition signatures for a ballot measure that would create an elected 13-member civilian commission to oversee the police. That commission would set policy, they would hire the chief of police, they would investigate complaints, they could discipline police. And so they delivered 12,000 signatures to the city to get a ballot measure on this. And the city would only verify 5,445 of those signatures. So they're continuing to gather signatures and hope to get that on the ballot. But this is, you know, something that's happened in other cities as well. You may remember in Atlanta, Georgia, where Cop City is being built and there are widespread protests against that. They also tried to have a ballot measure that was thwarted by the city. Minneapolis folks are not giving up. They're going to continue pushing for that. And then Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Back in 2012, members of the St. George region of Baton Rouge, it's a wealthy, mostly white area, tried to segregate that area. This is a majority black city, and they were trying to segregate the schools there. That didn't succeed. So they started pursuing the ability to basically split or secede from the city of Baton Rouge. And the state Supreme Court has granted that to them. Creating their own white wealthy enclave means that the city, which has a poverty rate that's higher than the national average. They have a little over 15% poverty rate, is going to lose $48 million in tax revenue, money that is desperately needed for schools and support for the community. So this is, you know, if there's concern about what's happening there, this is the wrong way to go about this. This is only going to worsen conditions for residents of Baton Rouge. I want to give a shout out to Susan Crane. She is an 80-year-old activist with the Plowshares, and she is going to be starting a prison term in Germany, 229 days, over her participation in protests at Buchel Air Force Base. This Air Force Base is a German base. It's also a NATO base. And it's the only one in Germany that has U.S. nuclear weapons, which is a violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so people have been protesting there for a long time against having nuclear weapons there and the danger that that poses to everyone, really. So let's be aware that Susan Crane is making this great sacrifice, going to prison in Germany for her activity to oppose nuclear weapons. Boeing in Washington State has now locked out its firefighters due to a breakdown in contract negotiations, they say. The firefighters have voted down two offers from Boeing. In fact, in the Seattle area, the firefighters at Boeing don't make a living wage. And so it's just interesting. Boeing that's had a lot of issues with safety and is trying to have this campaign saying that safety is a priority for them has now locked out the firefighters, who typically make about a little over four EMS responses each day and 0.2 airplane incident responses daily, so about one every 5 days. They're there to protect the safety of the workers. If they are exposed to chemicals or there's a fire or a medical emergency, they are there. But right now, they are not there because they are locked out. Maryland workers for Apple are stepping up their action. The Towson store was the first to vote to unionize in 2022. They have been in contract negotiations with Apple since January of 2023, and they just recently voted to authorize a strike at that store. They've not set a date yet, but they are upping their action to take action in support of their rights. And then very interesting legislation in Vermont may become the first state to make big climate polluters pay for the damages as a result of their emissions. They have an act that has passed the House in the state legislature. It's called the Climate Superfund Act. It still needs to pass the Senate and be signed by the governor. But under this act, they would calculate the emissions of the various fossil fuel corporations or any sorts of corporations that contribute to greenhouse gases, and then determine from that what their share is of the costs if there is a climate disaster, recognizing the contribution of those industries to the climate crisis. So the money would go into this climate superfund. Similar bills are also working their way through the legislatures in New York, Massachusetts, California, and Maryland. And then finally, I want to raise awareness of a new report from the Rainforest Action Network. This is a report on the banks that have been financing fossil fuel projects. And it's called the Banking on Climate Chaos Report. You can find that at ran.org, Rainforest Action Network, ran.org. And they found, for example, that $705 billion have been invested by banks in fossil fuel projects in just 2023 alone. they found that the biggest banks contributing to the climate crisis and these fossil fuel projects are JP Morgan Chase, Mizuho, and Bank of America. And if you go to look at that report, they show each of the different big banks and how much they've been investing in fossil fuels. So despite the fact that many of these banks are claiming that they're working towards net zero, they're continuing to fund these fossil fuel projects. They include information in the report about how many trillions of dollars have been invested in more fossil fuel infrastructure since the Paris Agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement, was signed. And, you know, this is, you know, critical, as we know that the climate crisis is worsening. And now a majority of scientists are saying that we are probably looking at 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius of temperature increase, and, you know, blowing past the 1.5 that the Paris Agreement was trying to aim for, limiting the warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Banks need to be divesting in fossil fuel projects, and instead they're continuing to fund them. So this report will be helpful to organizations who can use the information to go after and protest these banks, as many people have been doing. Protest actions at the banks, shareholder actions, divestment actions through all different institutions to get them to stop their use of these big banks as long as they continue to finance the climate crisis. So that's all the news I have today. We'll take a short musical break and return with the interview with Anne Wright.
Soldiers of peace are not fighting war, are not looking for enemies behind every door, are not looking for people to kill or to maim. The soldiers of peace are just changing the game. Men who were fighting for all of our lives are now fighting for children, for homes and for wives, fighting for the memory of all who fell before.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Anne Wright. Anne is a retired U.S. Army colonel. She's a former U.S. State Department official who resigned in protest over the Iraq War in 2003. And she's a prominent anti-war activist with Code Pink and Veterans for Peace and other organizations. Anne, thank you so much for taking time to join me today.
Well, thank you, Margaret. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So there's a number of things I wanted to speak with you about and things that you're involved in. But before we get to that, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the State Department. You left in 2003 over the Iraq War. And since October 7th and the events of the genocide, escalated genocide in Palestine, three people have resigned from the State Department over that. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, kind of how things were when you resigned over 20 years ago, and now we're seeing this kind of wave of resignations. What does that say to you?
Well, it says there aren't nearly as many people resigning as should resign over these policies. And certainly in 2003, where three of us resigned, three Foreign Service officers resigned before the Iraq War started, and then other people later on resigned too. But here with a genocide going on, you would think that, a genocide right in your face in almost eight months of the genocide, you would think that there would be a wholesale departure of Foreign Service officers and civil service personnel from the State Department. So it's kind of staggering to me that we've really only had one U.S. diplomat and two Foreign Service, civil service people from the State Department resign. We've also had one person from Department of Education that resigned, Tarek Kabash. While there have been lots and lots, like hundreds of people in the federal service that have written letters of protest on U.S. policies, the fact that not more people have resigned is kind of startling when you're looking at a genocide right in your face. That's where the U.S. government is complicit, and particularly the State Department is just outrageously complicit in the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
Yeah. So I also wanted to get your thoughts on the news that the White House is, quote unquote, recognizing that international laws are being violated in Palestine. I think that that this is kind of being spun as the White House actually cares about what's going on in Palestine. What are your thoughts on that new report that's come out and what that means for U.S. activities regarding Israel?
Well, it is the report on the implementation of the National Security Memorandum number 20, which requires that the State Department go to countries that are involved in conflict. And there are seven of them that they mention in this report. The one that we are most concerned about is the one on Israel-Palestine, the State Department query the government that is involved in this in the conflict and ask them if they feel like they have violated any aspect of the Foreign Military Sales Act, of the international humanitarian law, all of this. And then the State Department evaluates what the government sends to it to see if it is reasonable. Well, this is like putting the fox in the hen house, where you've got the Israelis that, well, we haven't even seen what the Israelis sent to the State Department. That still is classified. Mm-hmm. All we have is the response from the State Department, which says there could be incidents in which the Israeli military may have, done something that violates our regulations on the use of foreign military sales, military equipment. I mean, it's the biggest wishy-washy thing I have ever seen. Mm-hmm. It is everybody that had a hand in putting that thing together ought to be ashamed of themselves. And I'm sure that there are plenty of people both in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, in Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, in planning and strategy of the State Department. There are about four major bureaus that had a hand in writing that thing. And I'm sure that there are some junior officers and mid-level officers that are apoplectic about how this thing came out. Mm-hmm. I suspect they wrote a much stronger report, but it got up to the politicos, the deputy secretary of state and the secretary of state. And then they were told by them, you water that thing down. You make it so that it doesn't really reflect what Israel has done, and give us some wiggle room in here so we don't really have to stop foreign military sales, which is a part of that report that goes to Congress. And it's saying that there's nothing in that report that means that the United States should stop giving weapons and selling weapons to Israel.
Yeah. I mean, it's so obvious that what's happening right now in Palestine, and it's amazing that the U.S. continues to put forward this false messaging, which is why the resistance is so important. So let's talk about a few things that you're active in right now. One is the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition. You're a leader with that body. Talk about what the flotilla is aiming to do this year, and kind of give an update on what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, since 2008, and starting with the Free Gaza movement, that's when the very first little tiny boats actually sailed from Cyprus and made it into Gaza. There were five boats that got into Gaza in 2008. But then starting in 2009, the Israeli military has stopped every one of the 35 boats that we've sent to break the illegal Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. And if you remember, 14 years ago, in 2010, that's when the Israeli commandos executed 10 people on the Marvi Marmara ship and wounded 50. And the other six ships, the people on them were subjected to being beaten, tasered. I was on one of the ships, the Challenger 1, and everybody got pushed around, beaten up. So 14 years later, we have another flotilla. In fact, we have two of them that are on the move. The larger one that has three ships, a large passenger ship, even larger than the Mavi Marmara was, and a smaller passenger ship and then a cargo ship, are all still in Turkish ports awaiting reflagging, because the night before we were to put passengers on the two passenger ships, that's when the flag country, Guinea-Bissau, you know, a tiny little West African country that makes most of its money by selling flags to international ships that need a flag in order to sail around and go into various ports. Well, we had two of the ships flagged under Guinea-Bissau, and with pressure, intense pressure from the Israeli government, the night before we were to put passengers on the boats, we got a message from Guinea-Bissau saying they were canceling the flagging of our two ships. And without the flags, you can't move from a port. So that put us in, we're pretty used to Israeli conniving and dirty tricks on us. They've sabotaged boats before. They paid off the country of Greece not to let 10 ships sail in 2011. They paid off the Cypriot government. So we know that there's always sneaky stuff afoot. But this one kind of caught us off guard, that they strong armed the country of Guinea-Bissau to pull the flags. So now we are involved in making sure that we get flags from countries that will not bend to the pressures of Israel and the United States, and that we are able to actually move from the ports of Turkey and pick up passengers and then sail to challenge the continuing Israeli naval blockade of Gaza, implemented also by the United States with its armada of ships that are offshore of Gaza, and also to take humanitarian assistance, food, medicines, into Gaza, and to challenge the Israeli genocide that's going on in Gaza.
Right. I think you have 5,000 tons of aid that's loaded up and ready to be taken into Gaza. How concerned are you? You know, all right, maybe first talk about, when do you think that you will be able to sail?
Well, we are looking toward, now it looks more like it'll be June. We were hoping that we could get all this stuff resolved in late May, but it's dragging on to the extent that I think it's going to be to early to mid-June before we'll be able to get everything together, and then with pretty good confidence call all these people from all over the world. You know, we had over 150 internationals that came to Istanbul to be a part of the flotilla, and hundreds of Turkish citizens that wanted to be a part of it. So we want to make sure that we have all our ducks in order, that we've got everything ready to go before we call these people to come again to be participants on this flotilla to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And so now with the U.S. ships being present there, I guess they're building some sort of port, they say, to get aid into Gaza. How does that change things in that region, your concerns about the safety of the ships and their ability to get into Gaza?
Well, we definitely are concerned about the safety and security of the ships and the people that are on them. As we've seen, the Israeli military is, they've conducted a genocide on the people of Gaza, 34,000 or more people now dead, and probably 80,000 to 90,000 wounded, and tens of thousands whose bodies have not been found under the rubble, the total destruction, really, of the infrastructure of Gaza. So we are very concerned. I mean, we see that the Israelis have no problem killing international aid workers. They have no problem killing doctors. They have no problem killing journalists. They are a military out of control, and or under control of a government that's out of control, I should say. So we are very concerned about that. But, you know, we have people that are willing to put their lives on the line for this, that people of conscience that say, how could our lives be any more valuable than the people in Gaza whose lives have been taken by this horrific genocide? And that gives you real hope, you know, that as with, you know, the students all over the world that are risking their careers, their academic careers, and then their employment careers by saying our consciences are more valuable than what you are, what you, the educational institutions are demanding of us, which is to be quiet, be silent, don't speak up about a genocide that's going on right now. So we are concerned, but we know that the U.S. military has a large number of ships, including an aircraft carrier out there, several destroyers. And then you mentioned this crazy gold rhubarb thing of constructing a pier that actually has not been constructed off Gaza because of the heavy winds and seas. They've had to take parts of that pier and take them into Israel, into the port of Ashdod, in a area that's much quieter from waves, and try to put it together there. And then they're going to tow it back around 10 miles to someplace off Gaza, where this pier, and it really is a Rube Goldberg sort of thing, the pier will continue out. Well, there are actually two piers. There's a further out pier where the big ships will dock. And then that pier will have two little entrances for small boats to come into these small docking areas. And on board each of those two little ships will be two or three dump trucks, or trucks that are able to take cargo from the hold of the big ship. And they put it in the back end of these trucks in the little ships, and then little ships back up. They go over to the second pier, and the ships dock at that pier, and then the little trucks back off that and roll down the pier onto land. And then nobody has told us exactly who's going to take over the humanitarian assistance, the medical things, because with the UN Works and Relief Agency not being available because of, you know, the Israeli attacking it all the time, and the U.S. At least attacking it verbally, it's unsure who is going to actually deliver that. Mm-hmm. But once it goes someplace, the truck comes back empty and gets on the little tiny boat, and then the little tiny boat goes out to the big boat, and then the back end of these trucks are refilled. I mean, and this is the craziest scheme of all, because all you have to do is open up the gates of Rafah, and right. There are miles and miles and miles of tractor trailer trucks that are already loaded, ready to go in. So this pitiful attempt by the Biden administration to salvage something out of their failed and horrible killer policies is to anybody that knows anything about, you know, how the military operates and some of the crazy things that's been put in, this is one of the craziest I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. There are trucks ready and have been ready for months to bring aid directly in. And it's just another kind of distraction and delay, and the U.S. government trying to appear like it's doing something.
Yeah. Well, and I'll just to add icing on the cake, that other thing of dropping food by parachutes,
right?
That just, I mean, you just shake your head. Like, here the U.S. says, oh, our greatest ally in the region, you know, and we have to be so loyal to the state of Israel. And when the loyalty is such that you can't even get them to let food aid into starving people, and you're reduced to pushing food out the back of an airplane, and it lands in the water or lands on people's heads, and it's such a paltry amount. It just, you just have to wonder who in the world cooked that thing up.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw a video the other day, very sadly, of a group of people trying to get some, one of the aid drops from the air, trying to get that off the roof of a building, and the building collapsed. And
oh my.
And yeah, there was infrastructure there. The UN Relief and Works Agency, I think, had 13,000 employees ready to get aid into folks. And that's, you know, we've seen what's happened with that. So that's why the Votola is another very important endeavor to get aid in, but also to raise awareness of what's happening there in the blockade. You mentioned two ships. There's a ship that I think is currently in Norway. Can you talk about that one?
Yes, this is a project that we've had on the books for 2.5 years. This is sailing from Scandinavia, and then in 75 days, taking the ship we call the Houndella from Scandinavia down through Germany, then the Netherlands, then the UK, then across to France, up to Ireland, then around the Iberian Peninsula into Portugal, Spain, into the Mediterranean, and four ports in the Mediterranean before we finally move that boat toward Gaza. And that would be the early part of August. During all of this, we're stopping at 20 different ports and having solidarity events with Palestine groups that are in each one of the ports. Right now, the ship is in Malmo, Sweden, where it has joined the protests on Eurovision, a song festival. In fact, it sailed in just as those protests were happening. And so we have some great footage of that ship, the Houndella, coming in as a part of the Palestine solidarity. That ship also last summer, we took it on just a northern European trip that went to 12 different ports in solidarity. And then the plan was to use it for 2 years and this year take it all the way down into the Mediterranean and then sail it to Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic work and so important to keep building the visibility and awareness of what's happening. So what can people in the United States do to support the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition, or are there anything that people can do during the time that the ship is sailing to help protect it? What do you recommend to people?
Surely. Well, we do have a coalition website called freedomflotilla.org, and then the U.S. component of that. We have 12 national campaigns that are a part of the coalition, and our U.S. campaign is called usboatstogaza.org, and you can follow the trip of our ship through that, through the Houndella, and then through the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, we'll be giving updates on the flotilla, the three ship flotilla. Of course, donations are always welcome because this is funded totally through donations of people who are concerned about what is happening to Palestine. Mm-hmm. We invariably will need your help to contact members of Congress when our ships are taken by the Israelis, or if we have more problems in trying to get the ships moved out of different ports. Of course, sending emails to our Congress people is fraught with challenge because we don't have a lot of supporters. I mean, it's been pretty amazing lobbying in the U.S. Congress over the last 5 months to see what mean-spirited, evil people we have in our Congress. It is startling to hear the comments of so many of these people about they don't care how many people get killed in Palestine. It's just heartbreaking. And I hope every one of those people finds that their reelection does not happen this time, and that indeed their conscience, one hopes they have a conscience somewhere, but it's sure not showing yet.
Yeah. In fact, you've been in D.C. this week, and I understand that the Raging Grannies are there. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on around this weekend?
Surely. You know, this with Mother's Day weekend, and happy Mother's Day, Margaret.
Thank you.
The Raging Grannies, which is an international organization with many chapters here in the U.S., Vicki Ryder from North Carolina and Pocky Whalen from Massachusetts decided, well, it's time that the grannies come to Washington and grannies against genocide. You know, we've got veterans against genocide. We've got doctors against genocide. We've got teachers against genocide, all groups of people
come
to lobby in Congress. And so the grannies showed up on Thursday and were in Thursday and Friday going to congressional offices and then having a public concert on Thursday night, which brought so many people together and with music to try to help with the trauma, I think, that we all are feeling about what is happening and our impotency of being able to stop it. Despite all of our best efforts, the genocide still goes on. So this time to be together, to use music to try to keep encouraging people to keep up the struggle, was a really, really important event. So we thank the Raging Grannies for bringing us together again.
They're wonderful. I know they also were big supporters and have been for the healthcare movement that I've been involved in, and coming to our events and singing about that. And I think they were involved in our campaign against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They just do wonderful, wonderful work. So you're also in Washington, D.C., preparing for the 75th anniversary of NATO and the meetings that are going to be held there this summer. Can you talk about that?
Surely, yes. We have a counter summit to the 75th anniversary of the creation of NATO. Ours is called No to NATO, and it will be on Saturday, July 6th. We're having an all-day symposium on NATO and its negative effects on the world. And then on Sunday, the 7th of July, we'll have rally and protest and march in Lafayette Square right in front of the White House. Then, if people can stay around through the next week, that's when the NATO conference actually begins, on the 9th of July, 9th, 10th, and 11th. And it's going to be in downtown Washington, D.C., at the Washington Convention Center, which is startling to me. I thought for sure they would take all of these heads of government outside of Washington and put them in an enclosed hotel spa area that we wouldn't have any chance to see them. But they're putting it right in downtown Washington, D.C., so we need people come in from all over the country and really all over the world to challenge what NATO is doing, the warmongering that NATO is a part of. So we really hope that people can come and participate in the symposium. We'll have speakers that come from Europe, from Asia, as well as from the United States and Canada. And it will be a raucous time, I'll tell you. It'll be a good preparation for the political conventions that will be coming up later in the summer.
And lots of actions being planned there for, I think, I know Chicago, and I think, I can't remember the Republican one is taking place. Is that Minneapolis? Or
I think it's Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So those are going to be, so how can people plug in? How can they find out?
Well, if you go to notonato.org, we've got a good website that's set up there, and we're slowly but surely filling out the speaker positions. It's going to be really good. Actually, the website is No NATO Yes Peace, nonatoyespeace.org. And that gives the agenda, the graphics, the all there is to know about this No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference.
Yeah, and NATO, maybe if you could just explain a little bit to the listeners, because NATO has gone way past its original intention, or maybe not, because there was sort of a nefarious intention there to wipe out, you know, or prevent the rise of countries that might actually try to take care of their people. But can you talk about how NATO has been used as a tool of Western imperialism and is being expanded?
Well, indeed, you know, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was formed after World War II, was primarily for the European continent and U.S. and Canada. Well, now it's expanded. I mean, during the Clinton administration, it started pilfering off all of the former Warsaw Pact countries, those that had been aligned with the Soviet Union. And with the demise of the Soviet Union, despite the guarantees that George Bush the First and gave to Gorbachev, that there would be no pulling in the Warsaw Pact countries, that they would just leave them alone. No, that didn't happen. So the NATO has now expanded to most of the countries, and of course the conflict in Ukraine and Russia is in great measure over the Westerns, the West push, the U.S. and NATO push to get Ukraine to join NATO. And Russia, the Russian Federation, saying, now, wait a minute, that's one step too far. You know, you've already gotten all these other countries into it, but Ukraine is one that we're willing to take a stand on, and they have. And to the tragedy of so many people being killed in Ukraine and Russia, rather than resolving this by diplomacy, it has gone to a tragic, horrible war. It's also, NATO is expanding to its partners out into the Pacific. The Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand are now partners of NATO. They're not members of NATO, but they're partners. And NATO has military exercises in the Pacific. And in fact, the rim of the Pacific military, the largest naval war maneuvers that happen off the islands of Hawaii, where I live, this summer they'll start again, will have NATO countries that were a part of the naval forces that will be in these military war games. So mm-hmm. NATO is it's now a worldwide organization, and it sponsors wars. It was a part of the war in Afghanistan. They are expanding. Anytime the weapons manufacturers need a new place to sell their weapons, that here goes another war, and NATO's right in the middle of it.
Right.
So it's very important that we challenge NATO on its 75th anniversary, and we hope that lots of people will join us in Washington, D.C., July 6th and 7th.
Yeah. You mentioned, in some ways it can just feel overwhelming, the ongoing genocide in Palestine, which despite so many people around the world rising up and taking action, courageous action in solidarity with Palestine, and to end that, the continuing expansion of U.S. and Western aggression, particularly on, great power countries like China and Russia. But I was hoping you could speak a little bit to folks' morale and why we should not be giving up, even though it feels so daunting at times.
Well, isn't that the truth? I mean, of all times, we can't give up now when we see, people being genocided, 34,000. We have to be standing up to challenge our own governments. And, I think we're all so proud of all of the college campuses, the students there that have risen up and made their encampments and are willing to go back to the streets after the encampments are violently torn up by the police. Even though the students have been nonviolent, it's been the violent response by state-level governments, city-level governments, university administrations. It has really shown the sad and sordid face of militarism in our country, where our government thinks it is appropriate that people that are wanting for peace and stopping a genocide should have their encampments torn up and people being beaten up and arrested. So it's, it's startling, but it's not unheard of, that's for sure. And this new generation who is picking up the mantle and picking up really good, we all are so proud of them and want to do whatever we can to support them. Some of the most telling comments have come from some of these young people who say, well, my conscience is worth more than that college degree. I don't care if they kick me out of school or they suspend me. At least I've got my conscience, where these administrators have no conscience at all. Right. So that's a pretty darn good look into the conscience of so many of our young people today, that they're willing to stand up for right when the authorities are there slamming them down for wrong.
Right. And I think, the power structure always fights back harder when it's losing. So the fact that they're taking these measures, these severe measures, means that, they're feeling the impact of this. The popular power is rising, and this is the time to keep growing that, right? Don't give up, because we can win if we continue.
That's right. And, when you have the president of the United States that has the audacity to say, these not affect me at all. Well, he is just so out of it, so politically unhinged, so to speak, maybe, or un, just out of tune with what is happening. It just makes you weary of, you know, what kind of advice is he getting? We know what his advisor, Tony Blinken, is all about. He's totally Zionist on this thing. But you would think that there would be some people desperately in the White House trying to convince them that they're going down the wrong path forever. I mean, the infamy that the United States will live under for decades for our complicity in this genocide is just